I was driving down the highway, and I couldn't go fast enough. My foot was pressed against the gas pedal all the way to the floor, and I was barely braking 55 miles per hour in a 60 mile per hour speed limit zone. Back then, some of you know that I drove for a short season a 1977 orange, bright orange Volkswagen minibus. It was the only option available to me at the time. My car broke down, and my dad bought this thing as kind of a sales gimmick. And I was really resistant at first. Admittedly, I don't have much personality. I was in college at the time, but this compensated for my lack of personality. And for a very short season, I became one of the most popular kids on campus. Oh, you're the guy with the orange van. Yeah, that's me. Sadly, it had a short life, but that was probably the best for my ego. I loved that van, but it came with problems, as I have shared with you before. First of all, it was the door latches. All of them were broken, so you had to climb through the hatch to get in. About 50% of the time, this thing started. And if it didn't start, you'd have to take a hammer, and you'd have to crawl under the back where the engine was at and bang on the alternator. Get back, come around, crank this key, sometimes a few times back and forth before you could get it started. And it did not have heat. When you turned the vent on, when you turned the thing on, smoke would billow out the vents instead of heat. Well, I was on my way home from winter break, and it was a very cold Midwest winter break with no heat, as you can imagine, and trying to find ways to get home as fast as possible in a van that didn't go very fast and save myself. I actually had some dirty laundry in a basket sitting beside me that I intended to take home to get washed, and I was just grabbing pieces of dirty laundry, throwing them over my body to try to stay warm. The whole time I was frozen against the wheel, just watching and staying there, not moving at all. But my mind was racing. Just a few moments earlier, I had a conversation with a friend a couple years younger than me who was in high school, and he was a skeptic. He had a hard time with the idea of faith, but he knew that I had recently said yes to Jesus a couple of years before, so it sparked an interesting conversation, a conversation about God, a conversation about hope, but as I said, he was skeptical, and with good reason. We both had a debate background. We like to think about things. And then came the condition out of his mouth that so many of us have heard and so many times, and he said something like, I wouldn't believe God unless he showed up right now, right here, right now. Now, I don't remember what my response was in the moment, but I remember driving home in that freezing van, thinking a million times what I should have said differently, what I could have said differently in that moment to provide a more meaningful response. Well, if you haven't been with us the past few weeks, we've been in a series on the Gospel of Mark called Thy Kingdom Come. Kingdom Come, Thy Will Be Done. Kingdom Come, Thy Will Be Done. And last week we concluded Mark that ends surprisingly strange with women running away from the empty tomb afraid. Something that we learned is the blank space after that page is actually an invitation for us to make a decision, for us to decide what we're going to do with fear. So it ended at both an interesting, kind of sad, but also a compelling note for us to think about our future. Well, we have one more sermon in this series, and that's today, but there is no material left in Mark. So we're going to jump over to the Gospel of John and continue the resurrection story about an encounter that Jesus had after his resurrection, and specifically an encounter with somebody who was doubting, somebody who has become, whether earned or unearned, who has brought the name on himself of Doubting Thomas. Doubting Thomas. Here's the question. when we think about Thomas and his encounter with the resurrection, what we find is that the disciples, that Jesus appeared to the disciples and that they believed, but we also find out that there was one disciple not in the room, and that was Thomas. And then Thomas shows up later, and we realize that he doesn't believe. And in one way, we can understand that. We can sympathize with that. We don't have to be modern people to sympathize with that. Something like the resurrection was simply something that they never really observed. So it makes sense. We can understand the skepticism that came from that. Modern science was not invented again, but nothing like that has been observed, and it continues to make sense for us living in the modern world. We know that science doesn't provide all the answers, and science can sometimes be weaponized, or ideas can be weaponized in the name of science. At the same time, we live in a world of comforts and protections that have come from science. So science matters, and it gives us these universal rules that we can observe and rely on and grow and gain in. But is shutting the mind off the only way that we can take a step of faith? Is that the only way that we can take a step forward? Well, I don't know about you, but there are times in my life that I think when I am faced with a really big and difficult question, a question that I don't have an easy answer for, or a question that maybe confronts or demands something of me that I'm uncomfortable with, I wish that sometimes I could reach into my mind and just shut it off. I wish I had a switch. And maybe there are some of you who have tried that. Perhaps you were trying to please someone that you loved, or you were afraid of a different reality than what you were used to and uncomfortable with entertaining something that was different. Or perhaps some of you have found that curiosity is actually a really good thing, and curiosity in your life has led to better things. So you want to dig, you want to ask questions, you want to learn more, you don't want to narrow yourself and limit yourself to all that reality has to offer. Well, whether you're a skeptic or whether you're a person of faith who has big questions, or whether you are somebody who has been on this journey for faith for a long time and you haven't necessarily had a lot of big questions recently, I'm really glad that you're here, because what we're going to talk about is important today. If the life that Jesus offered is really as good as he promised, maybe life with him doesn't demand that we put aside or suppress some of these big questions. In fact, perhaps if we take our questions and go a step further, we'll find that they are opportunities to actually draw close to him. So how can we keep an open mind toward the truth without closing the door on the possibility of God? How can we keep an open mind without closing the door on the possibility of a life with God? That's the question that I want to explore with you today. And to do so, we're going to turn to the Gospel of John, chapter 20, starting at verse 24. But just to give you a little bit of background on this before we jump right into the story, the disciples have just had an encounter with Jesus. The doors are locked, but Jesus is able to make this mysterious entrance in somehow. John doesn't say. Jesus enters and he says, "Peace be with you." He imparts the Holy Spirit upon them. And then shortly after, we learn that one of the disciples was not there. And this is where we start in verse 24. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We've seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." Wow. What a statement. Kind of gross, too, right? You think about it. Kind of gross. Now, I don't think that Thomas actually wanted to put his fingers in the nail holes of Jesus. I think that he's probably using a little bit of hyperbole here, saying something like, look, chances are slim that this is true. The story is going to wrap up in just a few verses, but I really want to, I want to spend most of our time today just marinating in, thinking about what Thomas said here, because I think it's important. I think there's an attitude here. There may be an emotion. There's something that we need to understand about what's going on inside of Thomas when he is saying this. It's going to really help us as we understand the answer, the conclusion of the story. So I just want to sit here and process this with you for a minute. And there's probably more, but I could think of two possibilities, two attitudes that Thomas had with this. And I'm going to name them. The first one I'm going to call it the pragmatic approach. The pragmatic approach. And now it's possible that Thomas simply was struck by the incredulity of the other disciples' claim. Although Thomas was certainly experiencing the emotions around Jesus' death, perhaps simply here he's facing something that seemed logically impossible for him. And now we did this last week, but I want to do something similar to kind of help you illustrate it. Think of Spock from Star Trek. Or even the meticulous and somewhat compulsive Monk from the show Monk, for those of you who were fans and watched that. Or perhaps the skeptical, this one might be surprising, but the skeptical Indiana Jones, always looking for rational explanations in the face of supernatural phenomena. That one probably also fits. We can maybe rephrase Thomas's statement this way. What? Raised from the dead? I'm sorry. I'm just going to have to see something to believe that kind of a claim. Now, these kind of questions, they certainly have their place. When I was in college, I was pretty young in my faith, and I was actively devouring apologetics, books on apologetics. Apologetics is... it's a branch of theology that has to do with the rational defense of Christian beliefs. It is not the practice and act of apologizing regularly, which I know many of you husbands are very good at, but that is something different. Apologetics. I read things like C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, Josh McDowell's Evidence That Demands a Verdict, which is like an encyclopedia that nobody reads. You just kind of find areas to read in it. Or at that time, Lee Strobel's The Case for Christ and his Case For series was really popular back then. And they did really, really wonderful things for me during that time, just solidifying and giving me answers, helping me put my faith together in a cohesive way. But one semester I took a class called Science and Skepticism. It was led by a professor who was a Catholic atheist. I've never heard of such a thing before, but he called himself a Catholic atheist. And he'd often prompt the class members to try to find reasonable, rational arguments and studies that proved faith. And I just happened to be taking a sociology class at the time. And in the textbook, a study that was done on prayer. They commissioned a group of nuns to pray for this sample of people and not this sample of people. And well, it checked off all the boxes. It was a double-blind experience, a double-blind experiment, which means it removed all a bias from the equation. There was a large sample size. I remember just going to my professor, and I'm like, well, you know, what do you think of this one? And I won't forget his response, because it showed, you know, in that study at least, it showed that there was some evidence. And I just remember him saying, huh. And he seemed to say, well, this looks credible, you know. He opened his eyes a little bit to that. But here's the thing. Here's the thing about apologetics and where I've kind of come to over the years. I've come to be more cautious about apologetics today. Because if we can find reasons to believe, then we can find reasons not to. If we can find reasons to believe, then we can find reasons not to. Not all of those tests have the same result. And if it's true what the Bible says, that God cannot be tested, and if it's true that he is above nature and is all-powerful and is all-knowing, then he doesn't have to submit himself to human tests. Now, there are several rational and reasonable arguments for God. Some theologians kind of combine them down to five that people have collected over the year. But even rational and reasonable arguments aren't necessarily absolute, because God cannot be put in a test tube. What is uncreated cannot be measured by what is created. Doesn't mean they're bad arguments. It just means in one way of talking about this, they're not necessarily full proof arguments. In many ways, if we're having a conversation, if I was having a conversation with somebody who is skeptical, it would kind of leave us at a stalemate. A skeptical person might say to me, "Hey, look, it's really convenient for you that you have this idea out there that just happens to not be able to be proven in any way." And you know what? I would agree with them. It is convenient. It's convenient that for both sides, really, that God cannot be proven or unproven, that God cannot be measured or he cannot be unmeasured. In a way, it leaves us at a stalemate. Now, I have reasons to believe, or I have reasons, I have a way of understanding that. I think that Jesus in the Gospels connects the invisibility of God with his humility. He connects the invisibility of God with his humility, meaning that God is not someone who typically imposes himself. And that might have been an answer to my friend back in the day. This isn't why he just shows up on command, among many other reasons. So I could have provided an answer to it, but it wasn't a full proof. Well, I came across this phrase when I was doing some Bible study. Exegesis is the word. That's not the phrase, but it's when you do detailed Bible study in the original languages. And when you do that kind of study, sometimes you run across questions. What does this verse mean? What does this word mean? And sometimes there are several options for what those words mean. I came across this phrase, this expression that jumped off the page to me. And it really related more to study, it related to my life, more than to just what I was studying in the moment. And the phrase is explanatory power. Explanatory power. And what that meant is, when you're studying and you come across something that's confusing or seems odd, the question you ought to ask yourself, especially when there's many options, is what understanding has the most explanatory power? What makes sense? What makes the most sense of the things around it? We'll use the word context to describe that, but I like explanatory power. Thanks for humoring me with that little sidetrack, because here's how it applies to what we're talking about. When I look at the world, and I look at what I've learned about the world, and I learned through the world, through my understanding of God, through Jesus, what I find is that it's not something that I ever made up in my mind. It's not something that I could have ever discovered, but I find that it has explanatory power. My belief in God through Jesus helps me explain the world around me. It helps make sense. Is that a full proof? No, it's not a full scientific proof, as we sometimes use the word, but it helps me to make sense of the world, and I think there's some power behind it. Here's what C.S. Lewis said in a really similar way. I believe in Christianity as I believe in the sun. I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. So if you're struggling intellectually in this kind of pragmatic approach, if you're struggling with wondering if you can have faith and have questions, I would say that you don't have to shut off your mind at all. In fact, the Bible encourages us to continue to engage and to be thinkers and to test things, to examine things. That's what the Bible does. At the same time, there's not a full scientific proof for God. There can't be by the very nature of it. So to be honest, if you find yourself to be a skeptic on the other side of faith, If you find yourself to be there, some of these arguments, some of the arguments for God might be enough to move you more towards the middle, but in certain cases, the arguments by themselves might not be enough to move you to the other side if that's where you would like to be. But I don't think that that's where Thomas was coming from anyways. Oh, Thomas. We're talking about Thomas, right? Well, let's go back to Thomas. Actually, let's go to our second approach. We first talked about the pragmatic approach to Thomas's doubt. Let's talk now about the pain approach, second way of looking at it. Think of Dr. Spock's foil, Captain Kirk, or Tony Stark, who became a hero in coming to terms with the fact that his weapons were being used against innocent people. Or on the villain side, think of Anakin Skywalker, who couldn't control his feelings and fell to the dark side because his emotions were unchecked. Is it possible that Thomas isn't just simply acting out of incredulity, but he's also acting out of a deep sense of disappointment? Now, we don't know a lot about Thomas. The Gospel of John doesn't tell us a lot, but it gives us a couple of peaks, and I want to invite you in to look at these with me. First of all, let's go to John chapter 11, verse 16. Now, I can't explain all of the weirdness of John's Gospel, but there are a lot of misunderstandings in John's Gospel, especially from the disciples, and Thomas is no stranger to that. So when Jesus' friend Lazarus dies, we have this strange reaction from Thomas. He says, John says, Thomas, also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let's go also that we may die with him." Okay, misunderstanding aside, let's just take a moment and appreciate the deep sense of loyalty Thomas has here. Okay, that's crazy, yes, but hey, I don't want to abandon, you know, this team. I don't want to, let's go die with them. Like, crazy, but loyal. Maybe like a puppy. I don't know. Something like that. Once he finds someone to believe in, Thomas seems like he's the kind of person that will follow that person even to the death. Look at the next time we hear from Thomas, and this is on the night before Jesus was taken. Thomas said to Jesus, "Lord, we do not know where you are going, so how can we know the way?" Thomas is not only loyal, loyalty matters to Thomas. You might be able to sense the tinge of fear that Thomas has in this statement. "You're not going to leave us, are you? You're not going to leave us, are you?" So we don't know how Thomas felt, but based upon what we do know, there's a good chance that his demand for proof does not arise from a sense of pragmatism, but from pain. The one who demonstrated himself through incredible power to be God's son left them. He left them. Jesus abandoned them. If you've ever experienced abandonment, you know what that's like. You know what that feeling is. There's anger. Walls go up. There's something in you that wants to abandon them very often in return. You want to turn your back, just as you felt like they turned your back on you. Thomas could have said this, "I won't believe Jesus is raised, even if he parted the sea in front of me. I wouldn't believe it." Not because he couldn't believe it, but because he wouldn't believe it. Well, you know that the story does not end there, so let's pick up with the last few verses. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands? Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Thomas said, My Lord and my God. Then Jesus told him, Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed, yet have believed. This is the climax of the Gospel of John, these words right here. Thomas says something that is profound about Jesus. He says, My Lord and my God. Now, Jesus is called a lot of things in the Gospel of John, and there's some misunderstandings around a lot of the things that he's called, but he is never called God except for one other place, and that's at the very beginning when John opens up his Gospel and talks about this divine figure who was alongside of the Father at creation, and John says that he also was God. And when you dig a little bit more into the grammar there, it's like saying this, what God was is what Jesus was. That's a pretty profound, radical statement. But how did we get there? It's a week after Easter. Jesus comes to the same place. He does the same thing. He says the same thing. He says, Peace be with you. But this time, he addresses Thomas directly. Did you notice that John doesn't tell us whether Thomas put his fingers in the wounds? That's because he didn't need to. Some skepticism is warranted. Thomas had reasonable questions, as we all do have reasonable questions. But Thomas' doubt wasn't about whether Jesus could, it was about whether Jesus cared. And when Jesus came and addressed it personally, and addressed Thomas personally, that was enough. That was enough. J.D. Hoover and his wife, Leslie, have been at Christ Church for a little over a year now. And when he was growing up in California, he found that he was resentful toward God. His parents, they separated at a young age, and his mom was bouncing from church to church trying to find purpose in life. At least this is how he told it to me. And during that time, JD, come on up a little more. During that time, you'd said that your mom really wanted you to go to church. You didn't want anything to do with it. And you also found yourself resentful, and maybe even resentful towards God, because you looked at the families around you that had moms and dads that were together, and you felt like, or you were asking this question, well, why can't I have that? But there was also kind of this moment and this turn in your life where you started to see things differently. Can you share a little bit about that?
Is this thing on?
You sound great.
All right, thank you.
Hey, why don't you welcome JD, everyone?
All right, I'm about to be vulnerable here for a second, so bear with me. It's not the end of my story, it's just the start. So when I was growing up, you know, I had to be the male figure in the house, the kind of role model. And as anybody knows, as a kid, trying to take on that responsibility is a daunting chore. So I was very resentful. Every time it was church time, my mom said, let's go to church. I'd throw a fit. And tension grew in that. And then my dad in and out of the picture didn't help the situation at all either. But as I realized, I came across a couple mentors, you know, because in order to get to Christ without some sort of road to there, you're never going to know. So the mentors in my life kind of guided me that way. I had two in particular, started shaping me, started growing me in the faith a little bit, you know, still being a teenager. I had my doubts, and I was going to church for a lot of the wrong reasons, chasing girls, stuff like that. I can't help it, I'm handsome, so.
So Your wife might have something to say about that.
I got to add a little bit of humor in here because this is a little bit different tension than I'm used to in the military. So with that being said, I kind of followed two characters in the church that kind of guided me closer to. But then I joined the military and found out one of them had done some heinous things and ended up going to jail. So that's where the turn in my life kind of switched. I started believing, hey, if this guy is my mentor, like, do I want to go through with this, my continuation to be a Christ follower? So I was a little resentful again. So it's been kind of a roller coaster throughout the stages of life.
You said that there were some ups and downs after that. And JD has a story, and we can't tell it all, but... Man, the hardships that you've endured, and it's just really amazing. You really need to grab him after church to learn more. But there's something turned it around. Even though you were in this season of doubt because of seeing a mentor do some terrible things, something happened. What, tell us about?
So I still have one solid mentor there. It's kind of funny. This guy used to be in... a non-Christian band, had the long hair, had the crazy guitars, and he turned his life to Christ. But that's not the only thing that I got from that as I followed him. He started coming around, and what's funny is he'd come pick me up and mentor me, and he'd go to McDonald's to get a large fry, and we'd share a fry and some conversation together. But the other thing that struck me is... that route to becoming a man, a Christian man, is that he was in the military too. Funny enough, I took that around with it. So he pushed me that way. So, same with that roller coaster. You have your doubts and stuff like that. I guess you could call me a doubting Thomas. It's the tangible things that I look for most, something I can touch. And having people that are strong mentors and stuff like that guide you in the right direction if you can't touch him directly. So that's the kind of thing that I like. I need some direction, of course, being the oldest male in my family trying to take care of my brother and sister. I needed that direction because I was still immature and not old enough to go that route.
People in your life, other people in your life came alongside you and... Mm-hmm. They made a difference. They kind of became the hands and feet of Jesus, it sounds like.
Yeah. And another thing is, you don't just go to church. You've got to be involved. I spend a lot of time just kind of spectating. I'm also aware at all times anyway, thanks to the military, so I'm constantly looking around. But you engage yourself in classes like Alpha. We're going to anxiety group too. We're going to sign up for the parenting, so you guys go ahead and do that too. You got kids. So volunteering and stuff like that keeps you out of trouble and keeps you close to the disciples of God. So,
why don't you give this guy a round of applause? Getting these questions that we have in life answered, thinking through some of the mechanics of how reality works, about how God works, and all of these big questions. These things are important. Don't get me wrong. They're important. They really are. But no matter where you decide to be, whether that's with faith or out faith, there are still going to be questions. There will still be questions. The questions will still persist. If we're intellectually honest and if we're humble, we know that there's still going to be questions, and that's okay. It's good to pursue questions. But chances are the real barriers, maybe not in all, but in most cases, are emotional. Doubt isn't having questions. Doubt is putting up walls. Doubt is closing ourselves to possibilities. Doubt is deciding to stay hurt. On the one hand, the impulse to move away from that is not bad, because God designed us to with this innate bent towards protecting ourselves, and we need to protect ourselves. There are people who will hurt us. So on one hand, that impulse is good. But when our impulse to protect ourselves is kicked into overdrive, and it affects relationships with people who have our best interests at heart, that's when it can be harmful. Coaches can't help our bodies grow stronger without exercise. Parents can't teach kids fully the danger of a playground if they never take their kids out to a playground to have some risk. And God cannot make everything perfect in this world until His mercy has been given enough space to achieve its full reach. So when our impulse to protect goes into overdrive, when we aren't getting what we want, or when reality isn't panning out the way that we might expect, that's when doubt might be at its greatest potency to do damage. That's when doubt might be most potent to do the most damage in our life. But doubt does not have to have the final say. We don't have to deny ourselves the best that God has to offer, nor do we have to close our minds. We can experience life with God by keeping an open mind toward God and an open heart toward Him as well. We can experience life with God by keeping an open mind and an open heart toward Jesus. So what questions seem to be stumbling blocks for you? And what's driving those questions in your heart? Let me offer some brief action steps as a way to move forward. First, if you have big questions that don't seem to have big answers, simply do this: put a bookmark in them. Put a bookmark in those questions. It's going to be no surprise to you, but I love the scriptures. I love reading and learning and studying the scriptures. I love doing that because I'm curious. I just like learning. So honestly, there's a pretty superficial reason I like it. I also like to understand the world and how it works, and reading the scriptures helps me to do that. And I also experience the voice of Jesus. Most importantly to me, I experience the voice of Jesus in the scriptures. But I still have questions. I still have questions. And even when I dig in sometimes, sometimes I will dig in, the hours will go by, I won't come out with an answer. Putting a bookmark in those questions, it gives those questions permission to exist. It gives our minds permission to continue to think. And it gives those questions space to breathe. So many times I have come back with answers when I have come back to those questions with a better self. There have been so many times that I have found answers, even though I still have questions. Second, identify the emotion behind all questions. Look, you might be trying to solve the mystery of what baptism for the dead is in 1 Corinthians. And if that's you, good on you. There's probably 20 different possibilities, and maybe you'll come closer to the actual one. The motive and the emotion behind that is probably just curiosity. But often questions regarding hard Bible passages or difficult things, often those come from they're driven by something deeper, a sense of justice, an awareness of unmet expectations, fear that we're being asked to do something that's difficult, or possibly even resentment from past hurts. It's important to identify the emotion behind the question because of the next step, the last step, which is to recognize the value of the emotion and give God space to enter into that. It doesn't do any good to tell yourself to stop feeling something. Have you ever tried that? And how well does it work? Stop feeling that feeling. And feelings usually come from somewhere within us that's reasonable. A desire to protect, a desire to see something good happen. Putting words to those values diminishes the power of the emotions holding us back. And allowing God to come closer can flip them on their heads. What would it be like? What would it be like in these hard spaces to have caution turn into trusting, to have anger turn into love, to have resentment turn into peace? In these moments where Thomas was feeling all of these things, in this one moment frozen in time, Jesus did not pull away from him. Jesus drew closer to him. He extended his hands, and Thomas knew exactly what he was doing. That's all it took. That's all it took. And our hard questions, God does not shy away. He does not shame. He steps in. He presses forward. We can experience life with God by keeping an open mind and by keeping an open heart toward Jesus. Doubt doesn't have to have the final say. Doubt is something that we all experience, but it does not have to be the end of our stories.